Les colloques du Collège de France.
Racial borders. The expression may surprise a French audience and even hurt some delicate Republican ears. So let me clarify from the start a potential issue, even if I trust that for listeners anywhere else in the world, the phrase probably makes sense immediately while it legitimately remains problematic. Using the adjective racial does not imply the recognition of the existence of race, except as a social construct that serves to characterize, distinguish, and discriminate human groups based on essentialized features such as skin color, physical appearance, supposed origin, cultural traits, religious affiliation. By racializing people, one ascribes to them these features, which go with a series of attributes, generally, although not always, undesirable. Very often, people thus racialized do not recognize themselves in the portrait made of them. And even if they do, they do not accept that others would allow themselves to make such this depiction. They want to define their own identity, or rather, their multiple identifications. For instance, as being simultaneously an asylum seeker, a truck driver, a cinema fan, a French speaker, a Christian, a divorced father, a Cameroonian, and incidentally, a black person. In other words, not just a black person. Racialization is therefore a reductionist representation of people who are only regarded as members of a racial category. Ascribing them a single identity, moreover racial, is to deny them their status of subjects who decide who they want to be identified in which context. But what about viewing borders as racial? Of course, the line or strip of land delineating a sovereign territory and separating it from neighboring sovereign territories cannot be held responsible for the racialization of people. Yet, they are used for it. They become a justification for it, and they bear witness of it. Borders serve to distinguish and discriminate people, separating those who are welcome and those who are unwelcome, not on the basis of their individual qualities, for instance, academic achievement, professional competence, family relationships, risk of persecution, but on the basis of a generic category they allegedly belong to because of their color, their appearance, their origin, their culture, their religion. At the border between Italy and France in the Hautes-Alpes, where I have been conducting with Anne-Claire de Fossé an ethnography of migration, analyzing the interactions between refugees, volunteers, police officers, and public authorities, men and women from Afghanistan, Iran, Maghreb, West Africa, the Horn of Africa, are stopped, arrested, and sent back to Italy, whereas white men and women from European countries crossing the same border are not even checked. It should be noted that as a consequence of this discrimination, black European citizens are also subjected to verification of their identity on the basis of their physical appearance. A common justification of this practice by the police is that they operate such selection simply because there is a higher probability that a person of color be an undocumented foreigner. This is what Michael Banton calls statistical discrimination, which he differentiates from prejudicial discrimination. In other words, and more generally, one can say that the control of borders is racially oriented, independently of the racist intention of those who do this control, which can exist, of course. A police officer explained to me that to avoid being accused of partiality when he stopped a car with people of color inside at the border, he also stopped a couple of others just before and just after his target. Another one, who had only verified the documents of two passengers of color while ignoring several white ones in the compartment of a train near the border, told us that he used his flair, his nose, that is, his intuition, to decide which ones he would select. Such tactics, both factual, stopping several cars, and rhetorical, speaking of nose rather than eyes, show that these law enforcement agents were aware of their discriminatory practices. But they were under the pressure of a politics of pushback quota and had to arrest and deport people to reach their quantified objective. In other words, racial discrimination was not only the result of police discretionary practices, but also, and even more so, of national policies hostile to migrants and refugees. The latter knew about this situation, and they rarely crossed the border on the road, conscious that they would be checked, including in the bus between Italy and France. They climbed mountains near the pass on unsafe path, sometimes exposing themselves to serious dangers, especially in the winter, to avoid being stopped. In this case, racial discrimination is not only a moral issue, it has consequences in terms of life and death, as is the case in the Mediterranean, which has become the largest cemetery of migrants and refugees in the world. The racialization of borders can have various expressions. In Tunisia, a country with a long history of racism against black people, sub-Saharan Africans, despite their contribution to the economic development of the country, have recently been stigmatized by the president, Kais Saied, attacked by local people, and obliged to leave the country to escape violence. In India, whose partition has caused hundreds of thousands of victims, especially women, and millions of displaced persons, the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and his nationalist party are fueling violence against Muslims, excluding them from regularization as refugees and dehumanizing them as termites. In Turkey, the opposition leader, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, has tried to gain momentum among nationalists in recent elections by tripling the supposed number of Syrians in his country, accusing them of being a threat for young women and for national sovereignty. In the United States, the President Donald Trump has defended his harsh immigration policy by describing Jamaica, Haiti, and African countries as shitholes, by publishing an executive order imposing a ban on residents from seven countries with a large Muslim population, and by accusing Mexicans of being criminals, dealers, and rapists. Thus, in Tunisia, exclusion is explicitly about race, in India about religion, in Turkey about origin, in the United States about race, religion, and origin. Are these processes of discrimination and rejection similar? Isn't there a resemblance between these processes of otherization, which consider certain groups or categories to be homogeneous, essentialize their characteristic as being common to all their members, and debase them on the ground of these features? In that regard, the past two years have been a moment of truth for France. In August 2021, as the Taliban took over Afghanistan, imposing a strict Sharia rule and organizing repression on a large scale, the French president gave a televised address in which he anticipated he said, a flow of Afghan migrants against which Europe had to protect itself. In February 2022, so just a few months later, after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, Emmanuel Macron expressed this time his solidarity towards his population and declared that his country would welcome its refugees. In the following month, reception centers were opened all over the country for Ukrainians who obtained a temporary protection, an allowance, and a permission to work, while Afghans continued to sleep under tents in the street without resources and at the mercy of police repression. To justify the contrast which was observed in the entire European Union, not just France, between the welcoming of millions of Ukrainians and the rejection of only a few dozens of thousands of Afghans, some explained that Ukrainians were closer to us than the Afghan. But it was not a question of geographical distance, or not only of geographical distance. The distance was also one of color, appearance, origin, culture, and religion. Some expressed it bluntly, Ukrainians are like us. Even adding sometimes that they are white, Christian, and European. Thus, racial borders are about race in a broad sense, with combinations of different features such as being black, Muslim, African. In recent years, the expression Muslim is the new black has flourished in the United States. During the past month, in this very amphitheater, I gave 12 lectures on the trials of the border. Although I occasionally ventured on the African continent, where I conducted research 8 years ago on asylum seekers in South Africa, most of my references and examples came from the Western world, especially the European Union, the United States, and Australia. Today, we will expand our analysis beyond this horizon. Professor Bolaji Bolagun will talk about race and borders in Eastern and Central Europe, so still in Europe, but a different one. Professor Sarah Willen will discuss the racialization of otherness in Israel, so still in the West, but with different issues. Then Professor Radhika Gupta will analyze the case of Kashmir frontiers. Professor Yang Zhan will address the question of internal borders in China. And finally, Professor Natalie Pertz will explore the signification of race among refugees and migrants in the Horn of Africa. This wide angle on the world should help us answer two questions. First, is the language of race relevant when one studies countries where the word is not used, except as an imported product, usually from the United States? And symmetrically, what new understanding of social relations do we introduce when we speak of racialization? I do not want to force the language and the interpretation of autochthonous ways of describing and apprehending the phenomena, but I do not want either to miss the opportunity to enrich our comprehension of these phenomena by offering new concepts and proposing parallels. Second, is there a specificity of the West in the racialization of borders, or is there a common pattern across the planet? So beyond the identification of some similar facts and even logics in the discrimination, stigmatization, exclusion, and sometimes even persecution of others, on their historical factors that distinguish the West and the rest, or in today's wording, the global North and the global South. An obvious answer to these questions is the role played by colonialism and imperialism, even until today, in both the disruption of societies in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and the production of migrations from these regions. After having invaded their territories, exploited their resources, oppressed their people, Western countries, some of them, have established walls to prevent their people from entering the rich world. A few years ago, I developed a research program and later organized a scientific conference on borders and boundaries. The research was about France and gave birth to the collective volume Les Nouvelles Frontières de la Société Française. The conference was international and served as the basis of a book, Deepening Divides, How Territorial Borders and Social Boundaries Delineate Our World. In both cases, the idea was to connect two domains, one in which scholars worked about migrations and territorial borders, the other in which social scientists focused on race and social boundaries. Both domains had been prolific, but had long been without much intersection or dialogue, with few exceptions. How can we link the two? Thinking in terms of racial borders is a way to answer this question. As I was preparing this conference, I gave it for title The Racialization of Borders. But the formulation seemed a little pedantic or discouraging, and I decided to reduce it to a simpler and perhaps more provocative one, racial borders. A few weeks later, as I was considering the list of my guests, I realized that Professor Tandaye Atume, whose chapter Race, Refugees, and International Law in the Oxford Handbook of International Refugee Law, I had much appreciated and cited in my course, had chosen the same title, Racial Borders, for a recent 63-page article she published in the Georgetown Law Journal. 63 pages is the typical length of a paper in legal journals. It is a remarkable article laying down the theoretical ground for an understanding of the implications of thinking about racial borders. So discovering this unexpected coincidence, I asked Professor Atume whether she minded, and she graciously told me she did not. I therefore maintain today's title, Racial Borders, and I'm pleased and honored that she will open this conference with a keynote lecture. But interestingly, I later realized that, in fact, neither of us had coined the expression, which had been used 5 years ago in the title of a short article, Europe's Racial Borders, written by Professor Nicolas Di Genova, whom I invited to participate in this conference, but who could not join us. I suppose that, as is often the case, the idea of racialization of borders was in the air, and critical social scientists working in this domain were getting to the same conclusions. To complete, at least provisionally, this inquiry in paternity of our expression, more than two decades ago, the historian James Laker had published a fascinating book titled Racial Borders, studying how, after the Civil War, freed African-American men served in the US Army with the mission of protecting whites and their properties, forcing Native Americans onto reservations, and containing Mexicans in the South, thus establishing a complex and conflictive relationship between blacks, Indians, and Hispanics to the benefit of the whites. A remarkable example of the long history of racial borders. So I will now give the floor to Professor François Héran of the Collège de France, and later to Professor Sylvia Sebastiani of the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, who will chair the sessions this morning and this afternoon respectively, and will introduce for you our panelists, starting with Professor Tandaye Atume, who, due to a personal matter, was very sad not to be able to be with us. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.collège-de-france.fr.